Morgan Chase study showed that roughly 80% of customers had insufficient cash to manage the differences in monthly income and expenses, and any unexpected expense like healthcare or car repairs would wreck the family's picture for the year. They observed the income level, at which point income volatility stopped being a problem, at about $105,000 per year, a level far out of reach for most families. Often, people are unable to plan or budget effectively because they don't know how many hours they will receive at their store, restaurant, or construction site. 41% of hourly workers say they are not given more than a week's notice of their schedule, and many say that if they turn down a shift, it will mean fewer hours the following month. They thus live in a perpetual state of both scheduling and income uncertainty. The average worker dreads schedule volatility so much that they're willing to sacrifice 20% of their income for predictability, according to one study. Scarcity has a profound impact on one's worldview. Eldar Shafir, a Princeton psychologist, and Sendhil Mulanathan, a Harvard economist, conducted a series of studies on the effects of various forms of scarcity on the poor. They found that poor people and well-off people perform very similarly on tests of fluid intelligence, a generalized measurement that corresponds to IQ. But if each group was forced to consider how to pay an unexpected car repair bill of $3,000 just before taking the test, the poor group would underperform by the equivalent of 13 IQ points, almost one full standard deviation. Just having to think about how to pay a hypothetical expense was enough to derail their performance on a general IQ test and send them from superior to average, or from average to borderline deficient. Activating scarcity through a hypothetical expense was also found to reduce correct responses on a self-control test from 83 to 63% among the less well-off participants, with no effect on the well-off. A mindset of scarcity is more than just stress. It actually makes one less rational and more impulsive by consuming bandwidth. In another study, Shafir and Mulanathan asked two groups to memorize either a two-digit number or an eight-digit number. They then presented the groups with both cake and fruit. The people who were preoccupied trying to memorize the eight-digit number ate cake much more often. When an ethnic person served the study participants a repulsive traditional dish, the preoccupied group was more likely to be rude or make a racially insensitive comment. The group with the easy mental task had the bandwidth to restrain their reaction and maintain decorum. We all respond poorly to scarcity. Imagine yourself sitting peacefully at your desk in your office. Someone rushes in to tell you that you forgot about a meeting that starts in 5 minutes and you'll have to hurry across town to get there. All of a sudden, you burst into action. You hurriedly think about what, if anything, you have to prepare. You might be prone to forget your keys or some other belonging on the way out the door. Getting detailed directions to where you're going seems like it will take too much time, so you just head off in the general direction. You frantically text or email the person, "On my way, will be a bit late." Some part of you wonders how you forgot about this meeting, and if it's someone else's fault. You may become agitated and need to settle yourself down before you actually enter the meeting, taking a couple deep breaths to try to compose yourself to make yourself presentable. Or imagine a particularly busy day when you are forced to skip lunch. By the afternoon, you are fiending for something to eat, but you are in back-to-back meetings. Pretty soon, you are distracted and just thinking about whether anyone has a granola bar or if there's a vending machine nearby, instead of listening to what people are saying. Studies show that people on a diet are continuously distracted and fare worse on various mental tasks. The same goes for sleep-deprived people, lonely people, people with their phone on the table in front of them, and poor people who are asked to think about money. Different forms of scarcity are often tied together. For example, if someone lacks the ability to pay for their car repair, they may have to figure out another way to get to work via public transportation, and then figure out if they will make it back in time to pick up their child from school, and whether that means they'll need to arrange childcare, and so forth. When you're poor, these many choices define your waking hours and become almost existential and all-consuming. Any money you choose to spend means that you'll have less money to spend elsewhere, making every decision and calculation both important and taxing. Shafir, the Princeton psychologist, observed, There's a very large proportion of Americans who are concerned and struggling financially and therefore possibly lacking in bandwidth. Each time new issues raise their ugly heads, we lose cognitive abilities elsewhere. These findings may even suggest that after the financial crisis, America may have lost a lot of fluid intelligence. They don't have room for things on the periphery. One of the things that has struck me about the age of the internet is that having the world's information at our disposal does not seem to have made us any smarter. If anything, it's kind of the opposite. Most of us find ourselves struggling with scarcity of time, money, empathy, attention, or bandwidth in some combination. It is one of the great perversions of automation that just when advancing technology should be creating more of a feeling of abundance for us all, it is instead activating economic insecurity in most of the population. It's quite plausible that as steady and predictable work and income become more and more rare, our culture is becoming dumber, more impulsive, and even more racist and misogynist due to an increased bandwidth tax as people jump from island to island trying to stay one step ahead of the economic tide. One could argue that it is essential for any democracy to do all it can to keep its population free of a mindset of scarcity in order to make better decisions. A culture of scarcity is a culture of negativity. People think about what can go wrong. They attack each other. Tribalism and divisiveness go way up. Reason starts to lose ground. Decision-making gets systematically worse. Acts of sustained optimism, getting married, starting a business, moving for a new job, all go down. If this seems familiar, this is exactly what we're seeing by the numbers here in America. We are quickly transitioning from the land of plenty to the land of you get yours, I get mine. A mindset of abundance or scarcity is tied closely to what part of the country you live in. Different regions are now experiencing such different levels of economic dynamism that they often have utterly different notions of what the future holds. One's way of life is largely a product of where you happen to live. 11. Geography is destiny. Where jobs disappear. When jobs leave a city or region, things go downhill pretty fast. Youngstown, Ohio, immortalized in the Bruce Springsteen song, is a poster child for post-industrial cities hit by job loss. The city rose to prominence as a hub of steel manufacturing in the early to mid-20th century. Youngstown Sheet and Tube, U.S. Steel, and Republic Steel each built major steel mills in the city that supported thousands of workers. The population of the city grew from 33,000 in 1890 to 170,000 in 1930 as the industry boomed. Good jobs were so abundant that Youngstown had one of the highest median incomes in the country and was fifth in the nation in its rate of home ownership. It was known as the City of Homes. The city's steel industry was considered pivotal to national security. When union workers threatened to strike during the Korean War in 1952, President Truman ordered the Youngstown Sheet and Tube Mills in Chicago and Youngstown seized by the government to keep production high. For most of the 20th century, Youngstown's culture was proud and vibrant. Two major department stores occupied downtown, as did four upscale movie theaters that showed the latest films. There was also a public library, an art museum, and two large, elaborate public auditoriums. The city organized an annual community chest to help the needy. Steelwork was central to the city's identity. A local church featured an image of a mill worker with a quote, "The voice of the Lord is mighty in operation." The steel industry began to face global competition throughout the 1960s and 1970s. Youngstown Sheet and Tube merged with Likes Corporation, a steamship company based in New Orleans, in 1969. The mills were not reinvested in as corporate ownership left the city. The workers knew that their mills were not state-of-the-art and continuously agitated for more investment. Then, on Black Monday, September 19, 1977, Youngstown Sheet and Tube announced that it was closing its large local mill. Republic Steel and U.S. Steel followed suit. Within 5 years, the city lost 50,000 jobs and $1.3 billion in manufacturing wages. Economists coined the term regional depression to describe what occurred in Youngstown and the surrounding area. Local church and union leaders organized in response to the mill closings, forming a coalition that included national outreach, a legislative agenda, and occupying corporate headquarters in protest. They succeeded in prompting Congress to pass a law saying that plant shutdowns should have more notice. They tried to engineer a worker takeover of one of the mills. Government loan programs made it possible for some ex-steel workers to attend Youngstown State University to retrain. These efforts were largely futile at preserving residents' way of life. The mills stayed closed, and local unemployment surged to Depression-era levels of 24.9% by 1983. A record number of bankruptcies and foreclosures followed as property values plummeted. Arson became commonplace, with an average of 2 houses per day lit on fire through the early 1980s, in part by homeowners trying to collect on insurance policies. The city was transformed by a psychological and cultural breakdown. Depression, child and spousal abuse, drug and alcohol abuse, divorces, and suicide all became much more prevalent. The caseload of the area's mental health center tripled within a decade. During the 1990s, Youngstown's murder rate was 8 times the national average, 6 times higher than New York's, 4.5 times that of Los Angeles, and twice as high as Chicago's. Through the 1990s, local political and business leaders kept seeking new opportunities for economic development. First it was warehouses, then telemarketing, then minor league sports, then prisons. 4 were built in the region, which added 1,600 jobs but brought other issues. Many residents were concerned about the perception of Youngstown as a penal colony. One prison run by a private corporation was so lax that 6 prisoners, including 5 convicted murderers, escaped at midday in July 1998, and the officials didn't notice until notified by other inmates. National press descended on Youngstown, and the prison company apologized and paid the city $1 million to account for police overtime capturing the escapees. Another prison run by the county was forced to release several 100 prisoners early in 1999 because of inadequate staffing and budget shortfalls. In 1999, a 20-year investigation convicted over 70 local officials of corruption, including the chief of police, the sheriff, the county engineer, and a U.S. congressman. In 2011, the Brookings Institution found that Youngstown had the highest percentage of its citizens living in concentrated poverty out of the top 100 metropolitan areas in the country. In 2002, the city unveiled the Youngstown 2010 plan. The 2010 plan was an attempt at smart shrinkage through targeted investment and relocating people from low occupancy areas to more viable neighborhoods. The national media touted the 2010 plan as a blueprint for post-industrial cities, and the mayor toured the country to promote it. I love the realism behind the 2010 plan, yet it proved to be hard to execute. The city did not succeed in meaningfully relocating citizens from low occupancy areas and failed to complete its demolition plan. Youngstown has been the fastest shrinking city in the U.S. on a percentage basis since 1980. The population was down to 82,000 in 2000. Today it's about 64,000. Its largest employer now is the local university. Youngstown's story is America's story because it shows that when jobs go away, the cultural cohesion of a place is destroyed. The cultural breakdown matters even more than the economic breakdown, said John Russo, professor of labor studies at Youngstown State University. Echo journalist Chris Hedges in 2010, Youngstown, like many post-industrial pockets in America, is a deserted wreck plagued by crime and the attendant psychological and criminal problems that come when communities physically break down. Many young people left Youngstown to look for better opportunities elsewhere. One of those who stayed around, Dawn Griffin, single mother of 3, struggles to find employment. Although attached to her hometown, she was also planning on moving away in the next couple of years because there are no opportunities for her and her children in the area. Nostalgic, she remembers the better years of her childhood when her father was working at the steel mills. "I thought we were rich." She still wonders what is going to happen to her hometown. "There is nothing but concrete left here." The pattern one sees in Youngstown with the decimation of jobs, increased social disintegration, criminality, public corruption, desperate attempts at economic development, human capital flight, are not unique. They apply in other cities that have seen similar loss of industry. Gary, Indiana, is another steel town that lost jobs when the mills closed. It was the hometown of Michael Jackson and Janet Jackson back in the 1960s, and many locals described growing up there as ideal. After its decline, it became known as a murder capital, reaching number 1 in per capita homicide rate in the United States in 1993. In 1992, 20 local police officers were indicted on federal charges of racketeering and drug distribution. In 1996, in a bid for new jobs, the city welcomed two casino boats and legalized gambling on the shore of Lake Michigan. In 2003, the city invested $45 million in a minor league baseball stadium meant to revitalize the economy to disappointing results. In 2014, a serial killer confessed to killing at least seven people in Gary and depositing bodies in abandoned houses. Today, almost 40% of residents live in poverty, and more than 25% of the city's 40,000 homes are abandoned. The city lacks the money to demolish derelict properties and is considering cutting off services to many neighborhoods. Its population peaked at 173,320 in 1960 and is down to about 77,000 as of 2016. Reuben Roy, an 85-year-old former steelworker, recalled how beautiful Gary used to be and how easy it was to get a job when he started. "I started off working with a shovel and pick, shoveling and picking at things, but those jobs are gone. They got machines to shovel and pick now. The world has changed. Back in my day, you needed a strong back and a weak mind to get a job. Now you need a weak back and a strong mind. I would tell the kids to leave. Go get an education and go to where the jobs and opportunities are. They are not here in Gary anymore," said Imani Powell, a 23-year-old server at the local Buffalo Wild Wings, who returned to Gary after 1 year in college in Arizona to be close to her mom and sister. "I really would like to move someplace more beautiful, where you don't have to worry about abandoned buildings. There are just so many here. It scares me to walk by them. I don't want to end up a body lost in one of them. It is complicated for people who live in Gary. They don't want to move because this is what they are used to. Do you want to go and do your own thing or be with your family? They say places are what you make of them, but it's hard to make something beautiful when it is shit." The city of Camden, New Jersey, is another example of what happens when industry declines. Camden companies employed thousands of manufacturing workers in shipbuilding and manufacturing in the 1950s. Camden is also the home of Campbell's Soup, which was founded in 1869. After reaching a peak of 43,267 manufacturing jobs in 1950, Camden's employment base declined to only 10,200 manufacturing jobs by 1982. To respond, Camden opened a prison in 1985 and a massive trash-to-steam incinerator in 1989. Three Camden mayors were jailed for corruption between 1981 and 2000. As of 2006, 52% of the city's residents lived in poverty, and the city had a median household income of only $18,007, making it America's poorest city. In 2011, Camden's unemployment rate was 19.6%. Camden had the highest crime rate in the United States in 2012, with 2,566 violent crimes for every 100,000 people, 6.6 times the national average. The population declined from 102,551 in 1970 to 74,420 in 2016. Between 1950 and 1980, patterns of social pathology emerged in Camden as real elements of everyday life, wrote Howard Gillette Jr., a history professor at Rutgers. "Camden and the great majority of its citizens remain, after the fall, strivers for that elusive urban renewal that invests as much in human lives as it does in monetary return." Matt Taibbi in Rolling Stone described Camden as a major metropolitan area run by armed teenagers with no access to jobs or healthy food in 2013, noting that 30% of the population was 18 or younger. Between 2000 and 2013, the state of New Jersey cut back on subsidies that supported many of the services in Camden, resulting in a surge in violent crime. "The crime rate put us somewhere between Honduras and Somalia," said Police Chief J. Scott Thompson. The county took over policing later in 2013 and installed a $4.5 million security center, as well as 121 security cameras and 35 microphones to detect gunshots and other incidents, which has brought some degree of stability and a decline in violence. These brief descriptions are by no means full histories of these communities. For example, they gloss over the racial dynamics that each city experienced, as each underwent white flight during their declines. They also pay short shrift to the many heroic efforts to improve matters on the ground on a daily basis. I naturally root for the people who stuck around. The central point is this: in places where jobs disappear, society falls apart. the public sector and civic institutions are poorly equipped to do much about it. When a community truly disintegrates, knitting it back together becomes a Herculean, perhaps impossible task. Virtue, trust, and cohesion, the stuff of civilization, are difficult to restore. If anything, it's striking how public corruption seems to often arrive hand in hand with economic hardship. Many entrepreneurs have experienced the difference between being part of a growing company and being part of one that is shrinking and failing. In a growing organization, people are more optimistic, imaginative, courageous, and generous. In a contracting environment, people can become negative, political, self-serving, and corrupt. You can see the lesser side of human nature in most startups that fail. The same is true for communities, only amplified. One of the great myths in American life is that everything self-corrects. If it goes down, it will come back up. If it gets too high, it will come back down to earth. Sometimes things just go up or down and stay that way, particularly if many people leave a place. It's understandable. No parent wants to stick around the murder capital if they can simply move. Youngstown, Gary, and Camden are all extreme cases. It's unlikely that their situations will be replicated in cities around the country, but they are useful as glimpses into what a future without jobs can do to a community without something dramatic filling the void. Change can be a four-letter word. One of the first times I visited Ohio, a friendly woman commented to me, "You know, change is a four-letter word around here. The only change we've seen the last 20 years has been bad." I didn't really understand what she meant. I couldn't fathom how someone could have such a negative outlook. Months later, I was chatting with a venture capitalist in San Francisco, Jared Hyatt, about helping the Midwest. He said, "I was raised in Ohio. No one from my family is still there. All of us left." We mentioned another friend from Cleveland whom I went to Exeter with. He went to Yale and now works at Facebook in Silicon Valley. There's a truism in startup world. When things start going very badly for a company, the strongest people generally leave first. They have the highest standards for their own opportunities and the most confidence that they can thrive in a new environment. Their skills are in demand and they feel little need to stick around. The people who are left behind tend to be less confident and adaptable. It's one reason why companies go into death spirals. The best people leave when they see the writing on the wall and the company's decline accelerates. The same is often true for a community. When jobs and prosperity start deserting a town, the first people to leave are the folks who have the best opportunities elsewhere. Relocating is a significant life change. Moving away from friends and family requires significant courage, adaptability, and optimism. Imagine living somewhere where your best people always leave, where the purpose of excelling seems to be to head off to greener pastures. Over time, it would be easy to develop a negative outlook. You might double down on pride and insularity. The economist Tyler Cowen observed that since 1970, the difference between the most and least educated U.S. cities has doubled in terms of average level of education. That is, more and more educated people are congregating in the same cities and leaving others. Business dynamism is now vastly unevenly distributed. 59% of American counties saw more businesses close than open between 2010 and 2014. During the same period, only five metro areas, New York, Los Angeles, Miami, Houston, and Dallas, accounted for as many new businesses as the rest of the nation combined. California, New York, and Massachusetts accounted for 75% of venture capital in 2016, leaving 47 states to compete for the remaining 25%. Historically, virtually all American cities had more businesses open than closed in a given year, even during recessions. After 2008, that basic measurement of dynamism collapsed. A majority of cities had more businesses closed than open, and this has continued to be the case for 7 years after the financial crisis. The tide of businesses is no longer coming in, but going out in the majority of metro areas. In part because regions have been diverging so sharply, the U.S. economy has become dramatically less dynamic the last 40 years. As you can see in the accompanying PDF, the rate of new business formation has declined precipitously during this period. Compounding the problem is that Americans now move across state lines and change jobs at lower rates than at any point in the last several decades. The annual rate of interstate relocation dropped from about 3.5% of the population in 1970 to about 1.6% in 2015. The surge in regional inequality has coincided with a surge, not in people moving, but of people staying put. A series of studies by the economists Raj Chetty and Nathaniel Hendren showed how important where you grow up is to your future prospects. Low-income children who grew up in certain counties, Mecklenburg County, North Carolina, Hillsborough County, Florida, Baltimore City County, Maryland, Cook County, Illinois, grew up to earn 25 to 35% less than other low-income children who grew up in better areas. The best areas for income mobility, San Francisco, San Diego, Salt Lake City, Las Vegas, Providence, Rhode Island, have elementary schools with higher test scores, a higher share of two-parent families, greater levels of involvement in civic and religious groups, and more residential integration of affluent, middle-class, and poor families. If a child from a low-mobility area moved to a better-performing area, each year produced positive effects on his or her future earnings. They were also more likely to attend college, less likely to become single parents, and more likely to earn more with each year spent in a better environment. It may come as a surprise that Americans are now less likely to start a business, move to another region of the country, or even switch jobs now than at any time in modern history. The most apt description of our economy is the opposite of dynamic. It's stagnant and declining. Many different economies. During my travels, I've been blown away by the disparities between America's regions and their economic prospects. At the high end, you have the major hubs and coastal cities that are vibrant, competitive, expensive, and dominated by a shifting host of name-brand firms. Here you see continuous construction, incoming college graduates, and a sense of cultural vitality. People of color and immigrants are abundant. Growth rates are high and new businesses commonplace. You also see high prices. In Manhattan, apartments sell for more than $1,500 per square foot, so a 2,000 square foot apartment might cost about $3 million. The median value of a home in the United States is $200,000, and the average list price of homes currently for sale is about $250,000. So a 2,000 square foot apartment in Manhattan might cost 12 to 15 times what a home would cost someplace else. The premium prices extend to the grocery store, where a single serving yogurt might run you $2. It costs $15 in tolls just to drive into the city. Movie tickets are $16.50. Parking the family Subaru in the local garage costs $500 a month, which is what many people elsewhere might pay in rent. You see lots of people wearing sweatpants and sweatshirts with the names of where they went to school. Yale, University of Pennsylvania, Middlebury. In San Francisco and Silicon Valley, they don't advertise where they went to school, but the prices are just as exorbitant. Very normal-looking houses go for $2 million plus in Palo Alto and Atherton. The corporate headquarters of Google, Facebook, Airbnb, and Apple are insider tourist attractions. For the average tech worker, you wake up and drive from a leafy suburb to a grounded spaceship and stay there to eat the subsidized gourmet dinner. Or maybe you bike to your downtown office, or take the dark-windowed company bus from San Francisco and tap out emails with headphones on. You think about money and housing a lot, but don't talk about it. Most people are transplants. The atmosphere is quite different in mid-sized cities like Cincinnati or Baltimore, which are typically anchored by a handful of national institutions. Procter & Gamble, Macy's, and Kroger in Cincinnati, or Johns Hopkins, T. Rowe Price, and Under Armour in Baltimore. These regions are generally in a state of equilibrium, with the anchor institutions investing in community growth while organizations rise and fall around them. Costs are average. When new construction appears, everyone knows what it is because there have been tons of news stories about it. Occasionally, one of the major companies in the region starts to stumble, and the locals start to freak out. People move to these cities to work at one of the big companies, but a high proportion of residents and workers were born in the region. If you grew up in Cincinnati or Baltimore and go to college, you'll likely think long and hard about leaving. The vibe in these cities is pleasantly gritty, a blend of normalcy, functionality, and affordability. Then there are the former industrial towns that have hit hard times. Detroit, St. Louis, Buffalo, Cleveland, Hartford, Syracuse, and many other cities fall into this category. They often feel frozen in time as they were built up during the middle of the 20th century and then turned to managing various challenges. There are large buildings and parts of town that have been abandoned as their populations have diminished progressively. Detroit, the most famous example, today has 680,000 people in a city that once housed 1.7 million. The post-industrial cities have a world of potential, but the mood in many is quite tough. There's a lot of negativity and a lack of confidence. Many people apologize for their own city and mock it, often because they're comparing it to other places or its own past. A friend of mine moved to Missouri from California, and he said that people asked him over and over again, "Why would you ever do that?" A Cleveland transplant from D.C. made the same observation and said, "People here need to stop apologizing or making jokes." The positive manifestation is to develop a chip on their shoulder, like Detroit hustles harder. I tend to like places that adopt an attitude. One thing that has surprised me is that many of these places, Baltimore, St. Louis, New Orleans, Detroit, Cleveland, have a casino smack dab in the middle of their downtown. I've visited some of them on a weeknight and they are not encouraging places. Most of the people there do not seem like they should be gambling. Once when I was on the road in the Midwest, I ate lunch in a Chinese restaurant that had seen better days. In the bathroom, one of the urinals was broken and covered with duct tape. I thought to myself, they should really fix that. Then I reflected on the owner's thought process. They probably have razor-thin margins. If they spent a couple $100s on fixing the urinal, it may not make any difference to their flow of customers. I imagine for a second that they became really optimistic and spent a couple $1,000s sprucing up the place. The local area was clearly losing population and there was no guarantee a revamp would generate new business. I realized that, if you're managing in a contracting environment, it's possible that leaving the urinal duct taped might be a perfectly reasonable way to go. Optimism could be stupid. When you're used to losing people and resources, you make different choices. Finally, there are the small towns on the periphery, places that feel like they have truly been left behind. The ambient economic activity is low. There's a rawness to them, where you sense that human beings are closer to a state of nature. They have their heads down and are just doing whatever it takes to get by. David Brooks described such towns vividly in a New York Times op-ed. Today, these places are no longer frontier towns, but many of them still exist on the same knife's edge between traditionalist order and extreme dissolution. Many people in these places tend to see their communities as an unvarnished struggle for resources, as a tough world, a no-illusions world, a world where conflict is built into the fabric of reality. The sins that can cause the most trouble are not the social sins, injustice, incivility, etc. They are the personal sins, laziness, self-indulgence, drinking, sleeping around. Then, as now, chaos is always washing up against the door. The forces of social disruption are visible on every street. The slackers taking advantage of the disability programs, the people popping out babies, the drug users, the spouse abusers. The folks in New York and San Francisco and Washington, D.C. are people who have had layers and layers of extra socialization and institutional training. We are the financiers and technologists and policy professionals who traffic in abstraction. We argue about ideas. Our rents are high, and our eyes are set on the next hurdle to climb. We have the luxury of focusing on injustice and incivility. In small towns and post-industrial communities around the country, they experience humanity in its purer form. Their very family lives have been transformed by automation and the lack of opportunity. Their future will soon be ours. 12. Men, women, and children. Automation and the changing economy have already transformed millions of families and relationships across the country, and not for the better. 5 million manufacturing jobs were lost in the United States between 2000 and 2014. Almost 3/4 of manufacturing workers are male, so these changes disproportionately hit men without college degrees. The decline in opportunities for men has made working-class men less likely to marry. A study by MIT poverty researcher David Auder showed that when manufacturing work becomes less available, the proportion of men who get married in an affected community declines. Average male wages have declined since 1990 in real terms. A Pew Research study showed that many men are foregoing or delaying marriage because they do not feel financially secure. The same study said that, for women, having a steady job was the single biggest factor they were looking for in a spouse. Getting married is an act of optimism, stability, and prosperity. It also can be expensive. If you don't have a stable job, all of the above becomes more difficult. Marriage has declined for all classes in the past 40 years, with the decline being most extreme among the non-college educated. The proportion of working-class adults who get married has plummeted from 70% in 1970 to only 45% today. As you can see in the accompanying PDF, the decline really accelerated in 2000, around the same time as manufacturing jobs started to disappear. There are a host of reasons for the decline of marriage. Some cite increased labor force participation and more options for women, who are now less reliant on men. Others discuss it in light of shifting cultural norms. However, the reduction in opportunities for working-class men is doubtless contributing to fewer people getting married. The problems among men have been well documented. An Atlantic article in 2016 called The Missing Men noted that 1 in 6 men in America of prime age, 25 to 54, are either unemployed or out of the workforce, 10 million men in total. What are these men missing from the workforce doing all day? They tend to play a lot of video games. Young men without college degrees have replaced 75% of the time they used to spend working with time on the computer, mostly playing video games, according to a recent study based on the Census Bureau's time use surveys. Women are now the clear majority of college graduates. In 2017, women comprised 57% of college graduates, and the trend is expected to continue in the coming years. By the time you hear this, nearly 3 women will graduate from college for every 2 men. Women also go on to get a majority of master's and other graduate degrees. This is an international phenomenon. Women are the majority of college graduates in most developed countries. Fewer men in the workforce means fewer men who are considered marriageable. A working-class woman asked about marriage by journalist Alana Samuels said, "I haven't run into someone I'd consider doing that with." For women who don't have college educations, their male counterparts can't find jobs and don't seem like stable partners. Lower rates of marriage mean that the proportion of children raised by a single parent is rising dramatically. Though fertility is declining, people don't stop having children just because they don't get married. The share of children born to unmarried mothers more than doubled between 1980 and 2015, from 18% to 40%. Single mothers outnumber fathers more than 4 to 1. Of the 11 million families with children under age 18 and no spouse present, 8.5 million are single mothers. Most of the time, single parent means single mother. If you send uneducated men to the sidelines and turn them into non-providers, you wind up forming many difficult family situations and parents who then are hard-pressed to raise their kids. We see a decline in fertility, a decline in marriage, but a rise in a fraction of births that are disadvantaged. And as a consequence, the kids are living in pretty tough circumstances, said poverty researcher David Auder, commenting on a study on how the decline of manufacturing affected men and women. In the accompanying PDF, you can see the rise in the percent of babies born to unmarried women between 1940 and 2015. Boys raised in single-parent households seem to suffer more than girls. A study showed that growing up with stably married parents makes one more likely to succeed at school, but that an absent father had a bigger impact on boys. Boys without fathers are more likely to get in trouble from elementary school onward and appear to be more responsive to parental inputs or the absence thereof than are girls. As the authors of one study put it, as more boys grow up without their father in the home, and as women, especially in working-class communities, are viewed as the more stable achievers, boys and girls alike come to see males as having a lower achievement orientation and less aptitude for higher education. College becomes something that many girls, but only some boys do, the opposite of the earlier cultural norm. J.D. Vance made the same observation about school being something boys were supposed to ignore. "As a child, I associated accomplishments in school with femininity. Manliness meant strength, courage, a willingness to fight, and later, success with girls. Boys who got good grades were sissies. Studies now show that working-class boys like me do much worse in school because they view schoolwork as a feminine endeavor. I have 2 young boys at home, and I'm not surprised that boys who get less attention as children struggle. ADHD is 2 to 3 times more common among young boys than girls, with one 2015 U.S. Centers for Disease Control study finding that as many as 14% of boys received a diagnosis. Whereas some of my friends' daughters seem like little adults, my boys do not. Boys and girls mature differently, with the latter doing so faster and earlier. There is significant evidence that their relative maturity leads girls to be better at school. In 2012, 70% of U.S. high school valedictorians were girls, and girls attend college at higher rates in most developed countries. At the high end of the spectrum, college-educated women don't like to marry non-college-educated men, quite understandably. As the gender ratio of college graduates becomes nearly 3 women for every 2 men, this means that almost 1 in 3 college-educated women will not find a male partner to marry if they want one, even assuming ideal matching. Thus, among educated women, an increasing number of women will either raise children without a partner or won't have them. I see this in my social circles. I know many successful professional women in New York City who either don't have families or are raising children as single moms. Many of them are brilliant, beautiful, amazing women. In a way, it's fine, but in a way, it's far less than ideal. One mom who attended Harvard Business School confided in me that she constantly feels guilty that her daughter will be an only child, but she can't imagine trying to raise more than one child on her own. I understand. Having and raising children has been the hardest experience of our lives for both my wife and me. I was cocky going into it. I thought to myself, people have had children since the dawn of time. How hard could it be? Now I try to caution new parents that whatever they go through, it's perfectly normal, and to expect to have their lives changed and their spirits stretched. Having children has tested my wife and me as individuals and as a marriage. Both of us agree that we have no idea how any single mom or dad can make it happen unless they have incredibly supportive family members around. Data bears this out. Outcomes for children raised in single-parent households are significantly more adverse in every dimension. Education, income, rate of marriage, rate of divorce, health, and so on, even controlling for income of the parent. It also explains partially why 50% of Americans live within 18 miles of their mothers. After you have a child, you scramble for family. Frederick Douglass wrote that it is easier to build strong children than to repair broken men. What he left out is that it's also very hard to build strong children. I thought starting a company was hard, but being a parent is as hard or harder. I realized that there are many similarities between being a parent and being an entrepreneur. Here's a partial list. Everyone's got an opinion, but no one knows what they're doing. The first 2 years are brutal. No one cares as much as you do. On its best days, it fills you with meaning and purpose. People lie about it all the time. Choose your partner wisely. Heart is more important than money, but money helps. It is very, very hard to outsource. You find out who your friends are, and you make some new ones. Occasionally, the responsibility blows your mind. If you knew what it entailed, you might not get started, but you're glad you did. There will be 1,000 small tasks you never imagined. How you spend your time is more important than what you say. Everything costs more than you thought it would. Most of the work is dirty, thankless, and gritty. You learn a lot about yourself. You get tested in ways that you can't imagine. When you find someone who can really help, you're incredibly grateful. You have to try to make time for yourself or it won't happen. Whatever your weaknesses are, they will come out. You think it's fragile, but it will surprise you. You sometimes do things you weren't sure you were capable of. When it does something great, there's nothing like it. You start out all important, yet the goal is to make yourself irrelevant. People sometimes give you too much credit. There's a lot of noise out there, but at the end of the day, it's your call. It gives your life a different dimension. You grow new parts of yourself. It's harder than anyone expects. It's the best thing ever. Entrepreneurship is defined as pursuing an opportunity without regard for resources currently under your control. every parent pursues the best possible opportunities for his or her child while climbing over obstacles and limitations each day. So in a way, all parents are entrepreneurs. My mind almost broke trying to build Venture for America and raise children and stay married simultaneously, despite my wife doing most of the hardest work. You never rest. Basically, being a parent is a ton of freaking work, and doing it alone seems inconceivably difficult. That's what we're setting up more and more people, most of them women, to face alone. At a time when raising and educating children and forming our human capital is of the utmost importance, we're heading in the other direction. 13. The permanent shadow class, what displacement looks like. In 2015, husband and wife economic researchers Anne Case and Angus Deaton found that mortality rates had increased sharply and steadily for middle-aged white Americans after 1999, going up 0.5% per year. They figured they must have made a mistake. It's more or less unheard of in a developed country to have life expectancy go down for any group for more than a momentary blip. Said Deaton, "We thought it must be wrong. We just couldn't believe that this could have happened, or that if it had, someone else must have already noticed." As it turns out, yes, it had happened, and yes, no one had noticed. As Case and Deaton found, suicides were way up. Overdoses from prescription drugs were much higher. Alcoholic liver disease was commonplace. Historically, African Americans have had higher mortality rates and shorter life expectancies than whites. Now, whites with a high school degree or less have the same mortality rates as African Americans with the same levels of education. What was behind the disturbing trends? Case and Deaton point the finger at jobs. Deaton explained, jobs have slowly crumbled away and many more men are finding themselves in a much more hostile labor market with lower wages, lower quality, and less permanent jobs. That's made it harder for them to get married. They don't get to know their own kids. There's a lot of social dysfunction building up over time. There's a sense that these people have lost this sense of status and belonging. These are classic preconditions for suicide. They noted that the higher mortality rates and deaths of despair applied equally to middle-aged men and women in their study, though men experienced these at much higher levels. In the accompanying PDF, you can see the rise in deaths of despair by race among people ages 50 to 54 between 1999 and 2015. Many of the deaths are from opiate overdoses. Approximately 59,000 Americans died of drug overdoses in 2016, up 19% from the then-record 52,404 reported in 2015. For the first time, drug overdoses have surpassed car accidents as a leading cause of accidental death in the United States. Coroner's offices in Ohio have reported being overwhelmed as the number of overdose victims has tripled in 2 years in some areas. They now call nearby funeral homes for help with storage. The five states with the highest rates of death linked to drug overdoses in 2016 were West Virginia, New Hampshire, Kentucky, Ohio, and Rhode Island. Over 2 million Americans are estimated to be dependent on opioids, and an additional 95 million used prescription painkillers in the past year, according to the latest government report, more than used tobacco. In 12 states, there are more opioid prescriptions than there are people. Addiction is so widespread that in Cincinnati, hospitals now require universal drug testing for pregnant mothers, because 5.4% of mothers had a positive drug test in past years. Opioids are what we worry about most, explained Dr. Scott Wexelblatt, a neonatologist at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Perinatal Institute. People often think of opioid addiction as originating with prescription painkiller use. OxyContin hit the market in 1996 as a wonder drug, and Purdue Pharma, which was fined $635 million in 2007 for misbranding the drug and downplaying the possibility of addiction, sold $1.1 billion worth of painkillers in 2000, a sum that climbed to a staggering $3 billion in 2010. The company spent $200 million in marketing in 2001 alone, including hiring 671 sales reps who received success bonuses of up to almost $250,000 for hitting sales goals. An army of drug dealers in suits marketed addictive opioids to doctors, getting paid hundreds of thousands to do it. Regarding OxyContin, CDC Director Tom Frieden noted that, "We know of no other medication routinely used for a non-fatal condition that kills patients so frequently." A study showed that one out of every 550 patients started on opioid therapy died of opioid-related causes, a median of 2.6 years after their first opioid prescription. Now, many opioid users have graduated to heroin. One common pattern of addiction is that people use prescription painkillers for pain relief or recreationally as a party drug. They grind up pills and sniff them for a euphoric high that lasts for hours. Then they later switch to heroin, which opioid users cited as more easily obtainable. A study conducted by the New England Journal of Medicine showed that 66% of those surveyed switched to other opioids after using OxyContin. The majority of heroin users used to be men. However, because women are prescribed opioids at higher rates, today the gender balance of heroin users is about 50-50. 90% of heroin users are white. We are seeing an unbelievably sad and extensive heroin epidemic, and there is no end in sight, says Daniel Ciccaroni, a medical doctor at the University of California at San Francisco who studies the heroin market. We are not, in 2017, anywhere close to the top of this thing. Heroin has a life force of its own. Drug cartels have begun to sell heroin laced with fentanyl, a synthetic opioid that increases both the high and the addiction level and is cheaper than heroin, and carfentanil, an elephant tranquilizer so powerful that simply touching it can cause an overdose when it is absorbed through the skin. Our drug companies and medical system have produced hundreds of thousands of opioid addicts who are now heroin users buying from dealers. Heroin dealers have become ubiquitous. Ohio police say they've seen dealers text their customers to advertise two-for-one Sunday specials and offer free samples set up on car hoods in a local park. Some dealers have scheduled business hours. Others throw testers wrapped in paper slips printed with their phone number into passing cars, hoping to hook new business. Said Detective Brandon Conley, after arresting a low-level dealer in Ohio, "Everybody and their mom sells drugs these days. There's always somebody right there to pick back up. Many dealers are addicts themselves trying to keep a steady supply. This opioid plague will be with us for years, in part because treatment is so difficult. Heroin and opioids are notoriously difficult addictions to break. Withdrawal symptoms include cravings, nausea, vomiting, depression, anxiety, insomnia, and fever. Most people relapse several times on their way to recovery, and many are forced to use opiate substitutes like methadone to manage their addiction. Only about 10% of people that had a drug abuse disorder received appropriate treatment, according to a 2014 study. Most people can't break the habit on their own and require extended rehabilitation." Sally Sattell, a doctor and professor who has treated heroin users for years, said, "I speak from long experience when I say that few heavy users can simply take a medication and embark on a path to recovery. It often requires a healthy dose of benign paternalism and, in some cases, involuntary care through civil commitment. Treatment centers cost between $12,000 and $60,000 for 30 to 90 day inpatient care, with outpatient 30 day programs starting around $5,000 with no assurance of success." Hand in hand with the spike in suicides and addiction has been the incredible increase in applications to Social Security disability programs. Almost 9 million working-age Americans receive disability benefits. That's more than the entire population of New Jersey or Virginia. The percentage of working-age Americans who received disability benefits was 5.2% in 2017, up from only 2.5% in 1980. Disability applications started surging in 2000, the same year that manufacturing employment started to plummet. The average benefit size in June 2017 was $1,172 per month, at a total cost of about $143 billion per year. The age of the disabled has gone down. In 2014, 15% of men and 16.2% of women in their 30s or early 40s were on disability, up from 6.6% and 6.4% in the 1960s. Rates of disability track areas of joblessness, forming disability belts in Appalachia, the Deep South, and other regions. In a couple of counties in Virginia, fully 20% of working adults ages 18 to 64 are now receiving disability benefits. West Virginia, Alabama, Arkansas, Kentucky, and Mississippi are the top five states for disability beneficiaries, with 7.9 to 8.9% of the workforce receiving income replacement. Disability payments received by beneficiaries in these five states exceed $1 billion per month. In these areas, disability benefits are so widespread that the day that checks arrive is like a monthly holiday, said one West Virginian who processed disability claims. They're a vital part of our economy. A lot of people depend on them to survive. On the days checks arrive, you avoid the pharmacy, you avoid Walmart, you avoid, you know, restaurants. Everybody's received their benefits. Let's go shopping. Some of the increasing rates of disability reflect an aging population and changing demographics, but many of them represent what one expert called economic disability. The biggest growth categories of disability are mental disorders and musculoskeletal and connective tissue, which together now comprise about 50% of disability claims, nearly double what they were 20 years ago. These diagnoses are also the hardest to independently verify for a doctor. The number of people who applied for disability benefits in 2014 was 2,485,077. On any given business day, there are 9,500 applicants. There are 1,500 disability judges around the country who administer the decisions, often without seeing the claimants. The waiting period to get a hearing is now more than 18 months in most states. To apply for disability, applicants must gather evidence from medical professionals. They compile notes from doctors, send in the information, and wait to hear back. No lawyer representing the government cross-examines them. No government doctor examines them. About 40% of claims are ultimately approved, either initially or on appeal. The lifetime value of a disability award is about $300,000 for the average recipient. Because the stakes are so high, representing claimants has become a big business. Law firms regularly advertise for clients on late-night television to help them navigate the process and collect a fee, typically a percentage of the award. 80% of appealing claimants are represented by counsel, up from less than 20% in the 1970s. One law firm generated $70 million in revenue in 1 year alone from representing disability claimants. After someone is on disability, there's a massive disincentive to work because if you work and show that you're able-bodied, you lose benefits. As a result, virtually no one recovers from disability. The churn rate nationally is less than 1%. David Otter asserts that Social Security disability insurance today essentially serves as unemployment insurance around the country. It's not designed for this, but that's what it is for hundreds of thousands of Americans. One judge who administers disability decisions said that if the American public knew what was going on in our system, half would be outraged and the other half would apply for benefits. I spoke to a friend, Tony, about his experience applying for disability. He and I grew up together playing Dungeons and Dragons on the same street. Tony is a house painter who worked previously as a musician and sound technician. He was married briefly but is now divorced. Tony finished his college degree a few years ago at a public university. He went most of his childhood without health insurance. His father was a contractor and self-employed. In 2011, he moved to Western Massachusetts and received health insurance for the first time. It was free under Romney Care because he was considered low income. A couple years ago, after not being able to work for a few months due to health problems, Tony was told by his therapist, "You should try to get disability." Tony at first thought that he wouldn't qualify because his injuries were mostly brain-related. Multiple traumatic brain injuries from childhood accidents, a fall on concrete when he was 9, and a crashed scooter when he was 11, and concussions from playing high school football led to impaired cognition and mood swings. He also suffered from chronic fatigue, muscle pain, depression, and chronic Lyme disease. Tony took the therapist's advice and went on the Social Security Disability Insurance, SSDI, website to apply. He submitted notes from his therapist, nurse prescriber, supervising